Radio Buddhist Youth Association. Good day, everyone. You listen to the sound of universal compassion. Today's the 20th of July. We will continue listening to Master Tenzin Chosen's program with the book Mind Trainings Like the Rays of Sun by Lam Kapow. And please enjoy.
This show is brought to you by the Buddhist Youth Association every Sunday, bringing Buddhism to the community of the Waikato. We also give away a range of free English or Chinese Buddhism books, MP3 or tapes on Buddhism. If you'd like one, please send a letter with $3 worth of stamps in an envelope to P.O. Box 82146, Highland Park, Howick, Auckland. Or you can phone 09271-3377. Buddhist Youth Association, respectful, beneficial, empowering. Hello, and once again, welcome to the program. Beings come and beings go, but the flame of life, the generating impulse animating all existence and underlying the whole of creation, neither comes nor goes. It burns eternally with no beginning, with no end. Aglow with this enlightened awareness, one can die, not like someone being dragged, kicking and screaming to the scaffold, but like one about to embark on an enticing adventure. Such an exemplary death, let me emphasize, is causally related to a life artfully lived, a life dedicated to the fulfillment of one's physical, mental, moral, and spiritual potential. So writes the Zen teacher Philip Capello in The Zen of Living and Dying. It encapsulates the reason we've been talking about death and what it means to life over our last few programs. Presumably, everybody involved in this program has some interest in delving a little deeper into life and its meaning than those who live by the sex, drugs, and rock and roll culture. If so, it is important for us, from the outset of such an exploration, to come to terms with death, because it's, after all, the only thing that in our life we can be absolutely certain of. For sure we will die, all of us. None can escape. But if we understand the interdependence of life and death, we do not have to die, as Kepler writes, like someone being dragged, kicking and screaming to the scaffold. He points out that what we call death is just a change of state. He quotes Lyle Watson, the biologist who coined the term the Romeo error after the hero in Shakespeare's play, who, believing Juliet to be utterly deceased, took his own life. We too make that mistake. Watson writes, the Romeo error is a confusion of life with death and is made so often simply because there's no absolute difference between the two. They are manifestations of the same biological process and differ only in degree. Watson goes on to write, the death has no clinical, logical, or biological reality and exists only as a construct with validity in interpersonal relationships. To this, Kepler comments, the evidence of biology, psychology, and anthropology points toward the conclusion that life and death exist alongside each other in a constantly changing dynamic relationship. Death, then, does not extinguish the flame of life. It merely changes its form and direction. Put another way, death is not a full stop, but a comma in the story of life, as Verne McLennan noted. And so Kaplow is able to say later on, meditations on death are a means of purifying the mind in order to gain a crucial revelation of the meaning and significance of life. As such, death meditations have been regarded as an indispensable element in a wider range of cultures. The Egyptian and Indian, the Chinese and Japanese, the Hellenic and Roman, the Hebrew and Islamic, in both their ancient and modern forms. Because of death's general unfathomableness and the dread and terror it inspires in most people, the conquest of death, or deathlessness, has a central place in the teachings of all religions. Unless this fear and terror is replaced by comfort and hope, a tranquil mind state is impossible. The unwillingness to think of death is itself a kind of death, for the poignancy of life is inseparable from the knowledge of its decay. He says that the masters of old advised sticking the word death on one's forehead and keeping it there. We can even repeat the word softly as we inhale and exhale without letting it become mechanical repetition. Many years ago in Burma, I stayed at the home of a businessman with a spiritual outlook on life, Kepler writes. He meditated every day, and to judge from his serene, radiant countenance and deep contentment, he was 65 at the time, his meditations, though informal, were most effective. This is how he performed them. Every morning, he rose at 5 and seated himself, with his feet firmly on the ground, on a park bench, overlooking a brook that flowed through his property. He told me he made it a point not to slouch or lean back, but to sit erect. In his right hand, he held a long string of smooth beads, which he rubbed one at a time while he visualized each member of his family, then his friends, and lastly, those about whom he had harbored unkind thoughts. All these people he then embraced mentally, directing thoughts of loving kindness towards them. This exercise over, he began concentrating on the word death, more or less in the manner outlined above, fingering each bead as he focused on the word. This type of meditation is suitable for beginners and advanced students alike. Well now, keeping death pasted to our forehead, literally if you so wish, figuratively otherwise, now let's pause for a moment while we set our motivation for the program today. Bodhicitta, if you please. That is the motivation to make the program a cause for our enlightenment so we can benefit all others to the greatest degree possible. If you really, really can't go that far, then please motivate for your own liberation from samsara. Thank you. Now, keeping what Philip Kaplow said in mind, let's just briefly summarize the Tibetan death meditation practice we've covered so far. If you remember, this is an analytical meditation, and it starts with considering the inevitability of death. As I said before, we all have to die, and there are no exceptions. It then goes on to remind us that death is approaching inexorably. It does not stop and rest. It does not turn away. Instant by instant, it comes closer. How much have we prepared for its arrival? Generally, with this part of the meditation, we find that we haven't thought about death much at all. In fact, if anything, we see that we've avoided the subject as much as possible, especially as it relates to ourselves. Now, these 3 points, that death is inevitable, it's always getting closer, and up to now, I've hardly thought about it, never mind prepared for it, lead to the conclusion that I'd better start preparing. Then we consider that we have no indication when our death will come. We might have the idea that we will die sometime in the future when we're old, but that idea is swiftly put to rest when we look at all the people that die daily. Not all of them are old. In fact, people of all ages die every day. Death does not discriminate on the basis of age. Babies die, young children die, teenagers die, young adults die, as do middle-aged and elderly people. So we can have no idea of when we will take our last breath in this life. However, considering then what can cause our death, we see that we are surrounded by agents of death. Not only weapons, disease, natural disasters, and so on can take us at a moment's notice, but so too can those things we depend on to keep us alive. Our food, shelter, the very air that we need to breathe can also be the agents pointing us to the coffin. And if you also look at our body and its capacity for resistance, we see that it is indeed very weak. It easily succumbs to the smallest messenger of death, like a bacteria or a thorn on the stem of a rose. These 3 points, that we are profoundly uncertain of the time of our death, that we are beset by many agents of death, and that we have weak resistance, point to the conclusion that we should prepare for death from this very moment on. There should be no more procrastination. Then the last 3 points in this meditation consider what is beneficial at death and what we should do to prepare. We saw that all the things that are important to us in life, Our body, our possessions, and our dear ones cannot help in any way in the process of our death. Last week, we looked at some near-death experiences and saw how profoundly they changed the perceptions and lives of the people who went through them. As David Michie wrote in his blog, having a direct, undeniable, first-hand experience of consciousness continuing after the Western definition of death profoundly changes the way we view life. Our priorities shift. Material concerns become of less importance than interacting positively with others and living with greater compassion for those around us. In his commentary on the text we are following, Namkar Pel's Mind Training Like the Rays of the Sun, His Holiness the Dalai Lama explains it this way. We need to be very clear that at the time of death, nothing is of help except the spiritual training and the Dharma. None of the material objects and various things we may have collected will be of any help at the time of death. We'll just have to leave it all behind. Had we been the wealthiest person in the world, no matter how much money we may have had in the bank or investments, at the time of death, we certainly couldn't carry it with us. There's absolutely no hope whatsoever. The same goes for relatives and friends who can't be of any help at the time of death. There are people who seem so devoted they're willing to give up their lives for us, but they can't actually do that. If everyone has to die, what is the use of these people anyway? When the end of life comes, if I say, I'm a monk or I am the Dalai Lama, that will not keep death away from me, and I have to face my own death myself alone. Because having been born, there's nothing else for everyone here but to be leaving, alone, at the time of death. With all the people Mao Zedong had around him, the enormous army that he amassed, all the power he had, at the time of death, not one of his soldiers was able to help him or go with him, and he had to face his death completely alone. This body that each of us has been so intimately connected with, experiencing heat, cold, hunger, and thirst, will eventually have to split apart from the mind. We consider our body so important, yet it is just going to turn into a corpse. A corpse usually makes us feel quite nauseated. We consider it to be filthy and contaminating. But where does a corpse come from? It comes from our own body. Where do you think the filth of a corpse comes from? The body that turns into a corpse will not be of any help to us at the time of death. So in a way, it is very clear that the body, wealth, friends, and relatives, none of these things are going to be any help at all at the time of death. People, without thinking of death, go on accumulating and saving things, putting them in empty plastic boxes, then in wooden boxes. When they see a beautiful empty tin, they collect it and go on collecting, just for nothing, just to leave it all behind. So here, His Holiness shows how our body, possessions, and dear ones, all the things that bring us value and happiness during life, lose all meaning and value at death. He then continues to explain what is actually important at the time of death. He says, we've established that our mental continuum continues from past into future lifetimes, and it is on this basis that we have labeled the me and so forth. So the mental continuum is something that continues on, unable to carry any type of material objects. All that can go on with that mental continuum are the various potentialities built up in this lifetime. If we build up constructive potentialities, various types of positive force, this is going to benefit future lifetimes. Potentials are something we can build up through Dharma practice. Let's consider the various circumstances that occur at the time of death. We might have some sickness and go to various doctors who say, there's nothing that can be done about this now. It's going to be a long sickness. Now think how uncomfortable we may become, how everything becomes more and more desperate as we realize we are going to die. On the last day of our life, we just lie in bed terrified as the signs gather, watching life ebb away. There is nothing we can do. We have no control over the process. We eat our last meal, and medicine has no ability to help us at all. Everything just gets more and more pathetic. We want to speak, but we can't, Our lips are all dried out. Our ability to see, hear, and smell pass. Then our ability to breathe passes, and we just pass away. Whatever nice name we may have had during this life, it now turns out to be the late Tashi, or the late Kunsang, or whatever. So, if we think of the circumstances of our impending death and how it's going to happen, we need to have the firm conviction that only some type of spiritual practice can be of any help when death comes. Then, following in the text, he says that the most effective spiritual practice is developing the two bodhicittas, relative and absolute. Relative bodhicitta is the intention to attain enlightenment so as to be the greatest benefit to all beings everywhere, while absolute bodhicitta refers to the understanding and realization of emptiness, the lack of inherent independent existence of all phenomena, and their interdependence. In a talk on dying, the great Vietnamese master Thich Nhat Hanh addressed these two in a very direct way. You can find this talk on plumvillage.org. It is titled Meditations for the Sick and Dying, and about halfway through, the great master speaks about Anathapindika, a lay person who lived at the time of the Buddha. Thich Nhat Hanh says, his real name was Siddhartha. Anathapindika was a name given to him by the people in the city because they loved him. He had a good heart. He was a rich tradesman, businessman, but he spent a lot of his time and money taking care of poor people, people who were abandoned, children, orphans, and so on. That is why the title Anathapindika was given to him by the people of his city, Sravasti, and it means the person who takes care of the isolated ones, the unhappy ones, and so on. It was he who invited the Buddha to come and teach in his country. The Buddha before that stayed in the country of Magadha. Anathapindika, during one of his trips to Magadha, found out about the presence of the Buddha. He was very greatly inspired by the teaching of the Buddha, and that is why he invited the Buddha to his country, Kosala. And it is he who purchased the most beautiful park close to the city of Sravasti and offered it to the Buddha as a monastery, the first monastery in that country. Later on, it was called the Jetta Park because the owner of the park had been the prince whose name was Jetta. Anathapindika took great pleasure in serving the Buddha and the Sangha, and his family was a happy family because his wife and all the three children followed the teachings of the Buddha. But he was not given all the teachings of the Buddha because at that time people thought that lay people were too busy and should receive only the kind of teachings that they could afford to do. So the deepest kind of teachings were only given to monks and nuns. It was Anathapindika who made it clear to the monks and nuns that there were lay people who were very capable of practicing the deepest teachings of the Buddha. And he said, please, venerables, go back and tell the Lord that there are many lay people who are too busy and cannot afford to learn and practice the deeper teaching of the Buddha. But there are among lay people those who are very capable of learning the practice in these teachings. Anathapindika was very sick. He was about to die. This was after serving the Buddha for about 30 years. The Buddha went to him and visited with him, and after that he charged the Venerable Shariputra, one of his best disciples, to take care of Anathapindika. And one day Shariputra learned that Anathapindika was extremely sick. He might pass away at any time. So he went to the room of his younger brother in the Dharma, the Venerable Ananda, and asked him to come along for a visit. So both of them went to the house of Anathapindika. When Anathapindika saw them both coming, he was very glad. He tried to sit up, but he was too weak. He could not. Shariputra said, my friend, just remain where you are. You don't have to try hard to sit up. We will bring a few chairs and sit next to you. And after having said that, Shariputra asked, dear friend, Anathapindika, how do you feel in your body? Is the pain in your body increasing or decreasing? And Anathapindika said, venerables, the pain in me is increasing all the time. I suffer very much. It does not decrease. And when Shariputra heard that, he said, why don't we practice meditation on the three jewels? Let us practice breathing in and out and focus our attention on the wonderful Buddha, the wonderful Dharma, and the wonderful Sangha. And he offered guided meditation to Anathapindika, and both of the monks also sat there and practiced together with a lay person who was dying. So two monks supported a layperson practicing in this very crucial moment. Shariputra was an extremely intelligent person. He was like the right hand of the Buddha, taking care of the community of monks, teaching many of them as a big brother, and he knew exactly what the dying Anathapandika needed. So he offered first of all meditation on the three jewels, because he knew very well that the greatest joy of Anathapandika was to serve the Buddha and the Sangha. He did everything to make the Buddha comfortable and the Sangha comfortable. Therefore, meditating on the Buddha, on the Sangha, would bring joy and happiness that would counterbalance the pain in the body. Now, all of us have to learn this, because in us, there are seeds of suffering. There are seeds of joy. If you know how to touch the seeds of joy, they will be watered, and the energy of happiness and joy will be strong enough to counterbalance, to make the person suffer less. Thich Nhat Hanh goes on, the Buddha is the one who has the capacity of being there, of being mindful, of being understanding, of being able to love and accept, of being joyful. There are the 10 titles of the Buddha that people would repeat in order to touch those qualities, the joy and the peace of the Buddha. After meditating on the Buddha, they meditated on the Dharma. The Dharma is a path that can bring relief and joy and peace to us right away. We don't need to wait. The Dharma is not a promise of happiness in the future. The practice of the Dharma is not a matter of time. As soon as you embrace the Dharma and practice, you begin to get relief and transformation right away. And the Sangha is composed of members who practice concentration, mindfulness, wisdom, joy, and peace. To let your mind touch these wonderful jewels, that can water the seed of happiness in you. After about 10 minutes of practicing like that, Anathapandika felt much better already. Next time when you sit close to a dying person, you might like to practice the same way. You are there, present 100%, with stability, solidity, and peace. This is very important. You are the support of that dying person, and he or she needs very much your stability, your peace. To accompany a dying person, you need to be your best. Don't wait until that moment to practice. You practice in your daily life to cultivate your peace, your solidity. Then you look into the person and you recognize the seeds of happiness that are buried deep in him or her, and you just water those seeds. Everyone has seeds of happiness. We should know in advance. And at that moment, you talk to him or to her, you use guided meditation in order to help him or her touch the seeds of happiness within him or her. So every one of us has that kind of seed in us. Seeds of happiness, seeds of peace and calm. If we know how to touch them, we can help a dying person to die peacefully. We have to be our best during that time. We have to be calm, solid, peaceful, and present in order to help a dying person. The Buddha's practice of touching the ultimate should be practiced in our daily life. We should not wait until we are about to die in order to practice. Because if we know how to practice touching deeply the phenomenal world in our daily life, we are able to touch the world of the absolute, the ultimate dimension of reality in our daily life. When you drink your cup of tea, when you look at the full moon, when you hold the hand of a baby or walk with a child, if you do it very deeply, mindfully, with concentration, you are able to touch the ultimate dimension of reality, and this is the cream of the Buddha's teaching. Touching the ultimate. Thich Nhat Hanh then returns to Shariputra and Anathapandika and describes Shariputra guiding the dying Anathapandika on how he was not the sixth sense basis. That's the eyes, the ears, nose, tongue, and the body. He says, after having guided Anathapandika to practice watering the seeds of happiness in him, the Venerable Shariputra continued with the practice of looking deeply. These eyes are not me. I'm not caught in these eyes. This body is not me. I'm not caught in this body. I am life without boundaries. The decaying of this body does not mean the end of me. I am not limited to this body. They meditated also on how the objects of the six senses, that is form, sound, smells, tastes, and contact, are not me, nor thoughts or sight, hearing, consciousness, or the six elements. That is earth, water, fire, air, space, and consciousness. Finally, they came to the meditation of being a non-being, coming and going. Dear friend Anatta Pandika, everything that is arises because of causes and conditions. Everything that is has the nature not to be born and not to die, not to arrive and not to depart. And that led to Thich Nhat Hanh remembering a quote by the 18th century scientist Antoine Laurent de Lavoisier. Nothing is produced, nothing dies. That goes perfectly with the Buddha's teaching. Our fear is born from notions, says Thich Nhat Hanh. The notions of being and non-being, the notions of birth and death. Before we were born, we are taught that that was non-being. After we are born, we believe that that is being. And after we die, we think that that will be non-being again. So not only do the notions of birth and death imprison us in our fear, but the notions of being and non-being have to be transcended. That is the cream of the Buddha's teaching, to silence all the notions and ideas, including notions of birth and death, being and non-being. What is nirvana? Nirvana is the blowing out of all notions, the notions that serve as the foundation of fear and suffering. Even the notion of happiness can make us miserable, can create a lot of misery for us. That is one of the notions that should be transcended. There are basic notions that are the foundation of our fear and suffering, the notions of being and non-being, birth and death, coming and going. From where have you come, and where shall we go? The idea of coming and going is also a notion that we have to transcend. This is the guided meditation given to Anatta Pandika by Shariputra. Everything that is has the nature not to be born and not to die, no birth and no death, not to arrive and not to depart, no coming, no going. When the body arises, it arises. It does not come from anywhere. When the body ceases, it ceases. It does not go anywhere. The body is not non-existent before it arises. The body is not existent after it arises. It's not because of the manifestations of the body that you can perceive the body and you think that the body is. It's not because you cannot perceive the body that you can qualify it as non-being. When conditions are sufficient, there is a manifestation. And if you perceive that manifestation, you qualify it as being. If conditions are no longer sufficient, you cannot perceive it and you qualify it as non-being. You are caught in these two notions. The ultimate dimension of our reality cannot be expressed in terms of being and non-being, birth and death, coming and going. He goes on, it would be a pity if we practiced only to get the relative kind of relief. The greatest relief is possible only when you touch nirvana. Nirvana means the ultimate dimension of our being in which there is no birth, no death, no being, no non-being. All these notions are entirely removed. That is why nirvana means extinction, the extinction of all notions and concepts, and also the extinction of all suffering that is born from these concepts, like fear, like worries. When we begin to touch the phenomenal world, we see there is birth, there is death, there is impermanence, there is no self. But as we begin to touch profoundly the world of phenomena, we find out that the base of everything is nirvana. Not only are things impermanent, but they are permanent as well. You transcend the idea of permanence, and you also transcend the idea of impermanence. Impermanence is given as an antidote so that you can release your notion of permanence. And since you are caught by the idea of self, no self is a device to help you to get release from the notion of self. Touching the Absolute, not only can you release the notion of self, but you can also release the notion of non-self. If you have a notion of nirvana, please do your best to release it as soon as possible, because nirvana is the release of all notions, including the notion of nirvana. And with that, we must say goodbye, for now our time is up. I hope you got some benefit out of the program today and are able to join us again next week. Please dedicate any positive potential that we've created to gaining enlightenment for the benefit of all beings. Thank you, and farewell.